Welcome to The Human Code, the podcast where technology meets humanity and the future is shaped by the leaders and innovators of today. I'm your host, Don Finley, inviting you on a journey through the fascinating world of tech, leadership, and personal growth. Here, we delve into the stories of visionary minds who are not only driving technological advancement, but also embodying the personal journeys and insights that inspire us all. Each episode, we explore the intersections where human ingenuity meets the cutting edge of technology, unpacking the experiences, challenges, and triumphs that define our era. So, whether you are a tech enthusiast, an inspiring entrepreneur, or simply curious about the human narratives behind the digital revolution, you're in the right place. Welcome to The Human Code. Here today, Sharon Boulding, close friend, business associate, colleague for at least the last decade, and somebody who has had a touch on my life for over 20, 30 years now in various ways. So very happy to be here with you, Sharon, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Don. I'm glad to be able to speak with you today. So why don't you just dive right in and start grilling me?
It's the joy of having these conversations. So Sharon, I think you have such a unique perspective on what's going on in the tech industry. If you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about like your educational background and some of your passions that bring you into like really what it is in the technology space that you do.
Sure. I have a strange and different background. I came at technology sideways in that as a small child, I learned a lot of foreign languages and was part of a DARPA experiment at the University of Washington. And because of those experiences at an early age, and then working for DARPA, building computers from the age of 15, I determined that I wanted to teach computers how to understand human languages probably before the age of 12. To that end, I believed that compilers were the direct way that you spoke to the iron. In other words, we code in what looks like human languages to tell a computer what to do. And then the compiler translates it to assembly and ultimately binary. And that's how the bits flow through the hardware to get from place to place, whether it's through a cable or through wireless or just machine-to-machine communications. It all starts with that need to communicate to the computer what you want it to do. And so I joined Microsoft as an intern in the mid-80s, working in their compiler programming tools division. It was called Language User Education, or LUE. And we worked on a number of developer projects that basically brought languages to developers so they could speak to computers. So I have a longstanding interest in that human-to-computer communication. I had all the programming and hardware building type skills. And so I decided to do a PhD in linguistics so I could have the other side of the formula, which was the theory behind languages and how you transmit information and knowledge, not just between peoples, but between all sorts of systems. And so I got a PhD from the University of British Columbia, still continued to work at Microsoft, left Microsoft in 1990 while I began my PhD research, and worked with Paul Allen for a number of years at his first startup, Asymmetrics, and as Vulcan Ventures was getting going. And there also, we were looking at the early days of a programming language for not so much hypertext, because that didn't really exist in the sense of the World Wide Web in 1990, but a multimedia toolkit, again, a way to talk to computers and get them to transmit information both visually and textually to computers and back and forth between people using machines as the mediator between two humans. So human-to-human communication mediated through a machine.
Okay.
Just like we do today, right? You and I are talking to each other, but we're using the technology to mediate and transport the information from my place in Colorado Springs to your place in Philly.
Yes.
Right? That's mediated communications. It's still human-to-human, but it's human-to-machine-to-human, right?
Okay.
So that's always been my focus is how to teach computers to understand human languages to improve communications. And now we have this thing called data sciences and computational linguistics. Back in the 80s, when I was starting, none of that existed. We barely had a database. Excel had just barely been invented. Access didn't exist. RDBs were not even a thing. So I've been at this a long time.
Yeah. And it's amazing to see the translation of that human to computer interaction that you're talking about from like the 80s and 90s, in which we were really diving into high level programming languages as being that interface. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, right, like the advent of the GUI kind of coming into flavor and
layering over the top.
Exactly how that all plays. And now that's really like second nature to us. Like, I remember when the iPad first came out, seeing a toddler playing with it like it was second nature. And then she went over, yep, to a magazine and started trying to press on the images in the magazine because it's such an intuitive interaction that we have today.
And that reminds me of an interaction with my aunt, who is also my godmother. I was trying to teach her to use a computer in the early days of Windows. And she literally picked up her mouse and put it on the screen. I was trying to run the mouse around the screen like this, right? And get it to work, because I had told her, move the mouse cursor to the upper right. And she thought that meant literally placing it up on the upper right corner of the screen, right? And I was trying to tell her, no, there's a little icon on the screen when you move the mouse on your desktop, which at that point was literally the top of your desk. Then it moves on the computer screen and matches your motions of your hand,
okay,
right? My son's generation and that toddler you spoke about, they don't know a world where there isn't such a thing as an iPad or a smartphone. They grew up with all that technology. We invented it. And the funny thing about it is I worked on a project, again, in that sense of compiler and machine-to-machine communication for the Apple Newton, where all those technologies were invented, like handwriting recognition and touchpad and apps. The early days of the Newton was the first time you had an app on a handheld machine that actually was connecting to the internet to download data like a newspaper or bitmaps for the background.
Wow.
And all of that technology that we invented went into the iPod and the iPad and the iPhone and all those machines and handheld devices. It all started with the Newton back in 1990s when I was working with Paul and the team on how do you communicate between an Apple machine and a Windows system to back up your data and information off of this handheld device. How do you plug a wire into the back of an LTP port, which doesn't exist anymore?
I was just going to say, there's so many things that were challenges that we had to let go that just seem, it's second nature now that devices,
right,
connect with each other. Even across ecosystems, we see that. But one thing that kind of comes to mind is where we were at with the Newton and those early Palm Pilot devices that really led to having the technology available for the iPhone and for the smartphone to come, mm-hmm, together and be that, I want to say divine inspiration, but at the same time, it was more of one of those products just really captivated the market and was created at the right time and had the right appeal of being that device that combined your music, your web browsing, and a phone together.
Yeah. Yeah.
But today we're at a point where we're starting to see that like proliferation of LLMs and generative AI into the environment. Do you feel that we're at a stage where we're now seeing the iPhone, or are we seeing the Newton come to play? Or like, where in the product life cycle do you see us playing at in this generative AI space?
We're at an inflection point, but it's very different. You would not have the iPad or the iPhone if you did not have the Newton, because there were so many problems and challenges to overcome. And the Newton was too early.
Yeah.
People didn't understand the concepts. It was difficult to bring to market. It was expensive. And yet, if that work had not been done, the foundations for what later became these handheld devices would have had to been done anyway at some point in the evolution of the technology, both from a hardware and software perspective. With large language models and AI in general, the inflection point that we're at is both in the ability to process huge amounts of data and get knowledge and intelligence out of them. I'm not saying wisdom, because you have to know how to use the information in a wise manner. That's like ethical AI or quality control of the output But just getting knowledge in and then knowledge out is a fundamental ability, just like the Newton had to create those fundamental abilities, handwriting recognition, touchscreen ability, in order to enable further development of applications and hardware and technology that were truly useful. LLMs are at that infancy point, not because they're brand new, but because they've been able to stitch together 8 or 10 models to get a wider view of our world or the context in which the knowledge occupies mental space. The difference here, however, is that we're in a hype cycle. Everybody all of a sudden is very excited and knows about LLMs and is acting as if this is the great holy grail of knowledge management and knowledge extraction, when really, as with all technologies, it's been a stepwise progression. They said in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance, you stand on the shoulder of giants and you can see farther.
Yeah.
That was Rutebeuf. And really, what we've done is build up on all of the experimentation and knowledge and database manipulation and linguistics of the past 30, 40 years. Now the public is aware of LLMs and they see it in the newspaper all the time. And everybody wants to jump in like it's the Wild West and there's gold and then there are hills, right?
Yes.
Just like the early days of the web. And the web was just a graphical interface on top of what already existed as the internet. And so you have images now instead of just text. With LLMs, it's text. And they're getting more and more sophisticated around images and voice. Layering it all together simulates our ears, our eyes, our mouth, our brain patterns. What we're doing is emulating human speech and communication at a different level. When you think about it from a humanities philosophical point of view, the computers are learning to synthesize all this input that we do naturally in our brain and create output that simulates the real world. That's why it's called augmented reality or virtual reality. You're simulating what the real world is like via the computer. And once again, the machine mediates between humans and presents a creation of reality that is partial, because we don't have a complete correct worldview yet that you can say this LLM or that LLM instantiates or incorporates human knowledge at a deep enough level to be truly representative of everyone.
There's a lot of different ways that we could take this conversation. And I think that there's, you know, what's hitting the cultural zeitgeist right now is really that AI alignment opportunity that exists, right?
Yes.
Can AI can be this amazing tool for us, and at the same time, it can also be a weapon of mass destruction, right?
Yes.
Where it actually provides us with some damaging characteristics, but also some helpful. Where do you see hope? And where are some of the spaces that you think that we need to be a little bit more cautious about in the implementation of these technologies and also the advancement?
Great question. It all starts with the data, whatever you, garbage in, garbage out, whatever data you feed these models is what they will regurgitate back to you, the context, the information that you give them. And as Twain said, it's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Mm-hmm. What most people don't realize is that these models, as you say, are math in that they are purely statistical right now without reasoning capabilities. No matter what the tech bros say and the hype around, oh, this model is sentient or that model is sentient, it's not true. It's simply a marketing gimmick to get you all hyped up, right? But when you look deeper, you see a lot of hope in the areas of medicine. For example, these models are uncovering enormous amounts of data in the area of targeted gene therapies to investigate.
Yeah.
A lot of connections that were never seen before in best outcomes for medical practices to help improve patient experiences in their journey, not just in their ultimate desired goal of health. And wholeness is the same root, etymologically speaking, as health. You want to be whole in your body. You want to be healthy, right? The AI models get so much data that one human can never grasp in their brain, but they can get a holistic view of the space and create connections that a handful of researchers would never be able to handle just looking at it from a human perspective. So there's a lot of hope in medicine. There's also a lot of hope in finance, and that is in the area of creating opportunities for instruments and financial packages that are crafted to targeted communities. For example, I read an article recently where Hispanics are not projected to be fully integrated into technology and technology-based working scenarios, not just careers, but all sorts of jobs where technology is a singular aspect instead of the focus.
Yes.
Until 2070. And a lot of that is because of financial access to things like education experiences early on in life, like I had. I was very fortunate to have such early experiences with computers before desktop PCs even existed. In the late 60s, early 70s, you didn't just walk in and find a computer anywhere you wanted, right?
Yeah.
But even now, this is one demographic where if you can analyze the community and the needs of that community using AI, you can see opportunities to create loans and incentives and programs to help expose children early on to technology and STEM in ways that are nourishing and feed their brain and feed their enthusiasm to learn and grow, not just to play with an iPhone because it's got a cool game on it, right? But to really understand what's going on under the hood and look at it and see this is why it works the way it does and how I can change it and influence it with code. That demographic is underserved, but AI could really analyze the community and the situation and get banks and other financial institutions to provide support to help that community come up to speed faster.
I 100% agree. And a couple of years ago, I was working on a project with a large telecom company and a regional bank to utilize the credit reporting that the telecom company did to allow the bank to offer checking and savings accounts without, for people who don't really have a full credit profile, because the telecom company said, hey, we'll offer this service and we'll underwrite the account.
Yes,
and it allowed for the underbanked or the non-banked to actually be brought into the financial services community. And so that's a huge opportunity, I'd say, for the future of what we could do with AI, what we can do with these tools that are coming about today.
And many of these people who have low resources also don't have a permanent address.
Yeah.
And technology can provide a way, whether it's identification through biometrics that are held on the phone or other means, to give them those resources and that support in spite of not having a permanent address, right? Because they are a more mobile migratory community like farm workers or newly arrived immigrants who are trying to find a place to settle down. Another example where I find hope is really in language preservation for low resource languages. There are a lot of companies working to create apps and tools to gather data about those languages from the grandparents' generation that is dying out to make sure that the grandchildren who pick up that iPhone or pick up that iPad actually capture their traditional cultural data and information. It's not worth Google's time or Microsoft's time to capture the long tail of languages where there are only 5,000 speakers or 10,000 speakers left in the world. But these apps can use gamification and other techniques and then use AI to create dictionaries and vocabularies and actually then turn it around into more games and more apps in that native language so that the next generation can learn the language of their ancestors and not just be dominated by the top five languages in computing.
Mm-hmm.
One area to the next part of your question of risk around these LLMs is that they are primarily in a few top languages right now because it's so early on.
Yes.
English, maybe German and French, maybe one or two other languages like Russian, Chinese, but not in minority languages that are very targeted. You don't have models in Dutch, and yet Holland is a very prominent country economically, historically, right?
Yes.
There may be some university research groups trying to create them, but they're not dominant right now in this hype cycle. Areas like Estonia or Sweden or Iceland, where they're very technologically savvy, are trying to create those models so that their countries don't get left behind. Belgium is very focused on an effort in Wallonian and Belgian French to just really capture data and information and have an AI presence for their company so that it's not dominated by the United States, by Great Britain, by China, by Russia, right? Mm-hmm. So these countries are investing greatly because of the what we call cultural bias and predisposed racism. And that's what ethical AI addresses. It's not just that you have an unbalanced view of the world. It's that when you have outputs from those models, they reinforce certain cultural standards of the data that was used at the input to train them. So we have all this real hysteria around the fact that Google's latest model outputs racially different images and concepts of people who are historically white.
Yes.
And that swings the pendulum to the other extreme, which is how do you know and balance that when you're correcting for bias, you don't overcorrect, right? And it goes back to the human in the loop, quality controlling and adjusting and fine-tuning those models. And the danger is somebody can step in there and adjust it to a predetermined output that they want and really skew or target the interactions with the end users to manipulate social engineering,
yeah,
like the old telephone game where you pretended to be somebody else to get their data, right?
And we're seeing that as well as far as like misinformation campaigns. Justin, I think it was New Hampshire was in their primaries and somebody was robocalling pretending to be President Biden saying, don't go out and vote. Turns out that it was a company in Texas that, or at mm-hmm. least that's where the investigation has led to people pretending. The other point of information on this as well is LLMs trained in English show greater reasoning capability as like an emergent quality, right? They solve logical problems. Mm-hmm. But when you switch them into French or German, that capability drops off significantly. So even these emergent qualities that we're touting that may not be mm-hmm. absolutely perfect, like you're saying, we can't exactly trust them to develop wisdom at this moment.
Exactly. And the underlying reason for that is because the algorithms are done by English speaking programmers and their thought processes as they code those algorithms are according to the English way of communicating. It goes back to worldviews at the base of languages.
Yeah.
The French culture will produce a very different way of viewing the world, and that's instantiated in their language. If you just directly translate from English to French, you're not going to have a correct, what they used to call, localization effort.
Yes.
You have to go in and correct the logic and the way of thinking to reflect the way the French world views. And it's not a massive shift. It's a degree or two of shift, but it's significant enough to change the outcome.
Absolutely. So I know you have a son that's in his early 20s. And then additionally, like we're looking at how businesses are implementing these mm-hmm. technologies. What advice do you provide to your son in that generation as they're coming into the workforce, as they're finding their footing in what is a fairly exciting time, but will lead to a lot of changes?
Advice I give my son, as well as the people I mentor, is to have a technology component to your education, but also have a business component to it. And I've been saying this since the 90s. Just because you have a computer sciences degree doesn't mean you'll succeed. You also need the MBA so you can know how to survive in business.
Yeah.
And knowing how to code, at least at some level, will give you insights into what is going on around you and how reality is being manipulated by companies, by technology, by influencers who want to, as you say, change the outcome of an election or focus you to spend your money somewhere else because they want to profit off of you. Really, what I advise my son to do and what I advise most people to do is learn as much as you can, listen. It's dying skill just to listen to each other and have authentic conversations. Communication is the hardest business skill to have. And that's what I was saying early on was human to human communication mediated by the machine, right? It still all goes back to communication.
Yes.
Whether you're talking to a computer or you're talking to another human being, you both have to formulate your thoughts correctly, but also listen to what's going on, observe what's going on, and have standards, ethics that you pursue in your business, in your interactions in the world. Really, it comes down to being a good person and wanting to use technology for good as opposed to just a get-quick-rich scheme. So evaluate the companies you want to work for, evaluate your career, and determine where can I do the most good and have a profitable career so I can support myself and my family. And then pursue that with passion.
Mm.
Find mentors, find people who will help you and support you to grow in your career from that entry level. I'm still learning, even though I'm done with university. I now have to learn the tactical, the practical applications of all that head knowledge, but also the business environment in which it's operating.
I love that. So now from, let's say, the board perspective.
Okay.
Of like, you're looking at your own company and you're looking at the business and what do we do moving into this next decade?
I've been on several boards. I'm currently on 2 charity and 3 startup boards. So I spend a lot of time advising people about how to implement AI.
Yeah.
And in reality, a lot of my consulting practice is just that. How do you securely and safely embrace this, I hate to say brave new world, but next generation of technology? How do you prepare for the advent of quantum computing? And really what I advise them is, first of all, you have to know your own company. You have to deeply understand where is the data, what is its business purpose, and how is it currently being used, not just for compliance and regulatory reasons, but for financial reasons. Then secondly, how do you partner with other companies once you've protected that data to get the best business usage and financial benefit of that data? So you've collected the data, you know why you have it, you know where it's stored. Now, what are you going to do with it? An AI is driven by data. Therefore, security now needs to be at the data layer instead of the network or application layer. It's like that 7-layer stack. You put security at all levels, but most people don't think about securing the data at its root, at its source of creation. They only think about securing it when it's in transit.
Yeah.
Because they want to leave it exposed so that they can compute against it. That's no longer safe because AI will come and scrape your website or your archives, and the GPT bot will take it and insert it into OpenAI's ChatGPT model unless you protect it. And people aren't aware of some of these things going on, so they don't protect their data early enough, right? At that point, you can say, I can partner and charge a company for using my data, or we're in a relationship and we exchange data. I use theirs, they use mine through a secure API, and we both benefit. Thinking it through in terms of the benefit to the business and the benefit to end users is the best way to go, because in this current situation, there are a lot of technologies out there trying to get a hold of your data through any means possible as a corporation, and then use it so that they can monetize it, so that they can sell it through their API into their big collection of this data lake that was used to train their models.
Exactly.
Right? So you can create your own local model instead of using theirs, or you can fine tune theirs with your local data. There are a lot of techniques around that.
So a big thing that businesses should be looking at today is how you're generating data, how you're protecting that data, and the security that comes from not just your capability in utilizing your own data, but ensuring that nobody else is really using it as well. And I can share that in my conversations with boards as well. It's the same conversation around making sure that you own it.
That nobody is using your data. It's that they're using it with your permission.
Yes.
And you're getting some sort of payment for that so that you benefit from all that hard work of having collected it in the first place.
Exactly. I got to say, thank you so much for spending the time today to talk to us. As always, like, I enjoy our time together and like really appreciate this. Is there anything you want to say in closing, or is there any way that people can reach out to you if they have any follow-ups?
Sure. The thing I would say in closing is it's all about the data and being aware of that. And if they want to contact me, they can reach me at boldingbroke.com or boldingbroke@gmail.com.
Cool.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on today, Don.
Absolutely. Really appreciate you. Thank you for tuning into The Human Code, sponsored by Findustries, where we harness AI to elevate your business. By improving operational efficiency and accelerating growth, we turn opportunities into reality. Let Findustries be your guide to AI mastery, making success inevitable. Explore how at findustries.co.